Welcome to Sure Words, the ASPN podcast of coastal literature, the factual and fictional accounts that transport us toward the shore. I'm Leslie Ewing, the host of Sure Words, and in each episode, I talk with authors about their coastal writing and with coastal leaders about the tales and stories that inspired their chosen paths. Today, it's my great pleasure to be talking with Rosanna Shaw about writing and her favorite books, one of which is my favorite book right now, I think, California Against the Sea, Visions for Our Vanishing Coastline. So, Rosanna, thank you so much for writing this book. I know it was a little bit of a, well, always writing books is an act of patience and kind, but it's something that we so needed to have. But what started your interest in the coast or in the California coast in particular?
Yeah, and it is an honor to be on this podcast, and I am so happy to hear that I have written one of your favorite books, so that is truly an honor. And yeah, so at the Los Angeles Times, I am on the environment team, and we do, I feel so lucky to be on a team where we have so many reporters who specialize in specific beats within kind of the realm of environmental coverage. So, you know, I have a colleague who writes about water, I have a colleague who writes about air quality, another one on clean energy and wildfires. So I get to focus specifically on coastal and ocean issues. And so when I first started covering the coast, the California coast for the LA Times, I would, you know, go to all these different cities and towns, just meeting people and listening to the issues being discussed in city council meetings, and sea level rise was just this recurring issue that loomed over everything. But everyone seemed stuck. And I remember running back to my editor every time wanting to like write all these stories from all these different places. But he told me, hey, let's pause and let's think about, you know, whether we would be, you know, writing essentially the same story 30, 40 different times, asking the same question just from a slightly different place. And so it ended up becoming this kind of bigger journey of figuring out how to tell this broader, more cohesive story about California and our, you know, more than 1,200 mile long coastline. And so I did start writing a number of articles that kind of started to like piece together this bigger picture. And yeah, I mean, like consider this book almost like an extension of all of my reporting on sea level rise from the past few years. But I've been telling people, yes, this is my reporting, but it's like my LA Times articles with a lot more soul and a lot more storytelling, you know, and part of the journey of transcending my reporting and, you know, writing a book was thinking about how to really, truly bring together all these different pieces and all these different communities and, you know, really tell one interwoven story about the California coast, you know, which I'm biased here, I guess, is arguably one of the most iconic coastlines in the world. I mean, I'm talking to you, Leslie, but yes, the story about California truly has been just so fascinating. And it's just the nuances and just getting into kind of all of these different pieces, but then being able to step back again to think about how do we weave together this bigger picture.
And I think the word soul is so important to your book. It really does come through that you care about the places, you care about the people, you're really interested in what it is you're doing. And did I miss like having to do the midnight night court type of things with the LA Times first, or did you just get to jump into the most important part of the coastal environment or the environment with the coast as your first beat?
Oh no, I started at the LA Times on the copy desk. So that's the last set of eyes on any article. And, you know, I was proofreading, copy editing, grammar checks, style consistency, quote checks. And I was working like the 2:30 to midnight shift my first year or two at the paper. And then I became a breaking news general assignment reporter. I covered a number of beats before I joined the environment team. And I would say kind of my foray into environmental coverage in general, I was on breaking news. I got sent to a lot of wildfires. I covered earthquakes and kind of that type of disaster preparedness realm of coverage. I wrote about the last El Nino, the last drought, which is arguably still happening. And, Yeah, debris flows, landslides. I joked for a while that I wrote about all the reasons why California should not have been built in the first place, and that's probably a very morbid joke. But yeah, and I think, you know, for a while my editors and my colleagues considered me the natural disasters breaking news reporter. And, you know, given kind of the spirit of your podcast, I've been thinking a lot about the word natural disasters and what is actually natural and what is actually the disaster. And in the case of sea level rise, I mean, we're the disaster, right? Like, we are in the way of the ocean, and we have placed ourselves, you know, on the coastline in a way that is, you know, inherently in conflict with the way the coast works.
I mean, you talk about the natural disasters that you covered while you were at the LA Times, and I think you bring an extension of that into the book when you talk about it as California get against the sea and the visions of our vanishing coastline, that we are at a point along the coast where we're seeing a lot of the climate consequences, unfortunately, too up close and too immediate. And it's a hard one to address, and yet you do it with a nice balance in your book. Was there a roadmap you had to sort of start, middle, end, that you wanted to use your stories to convey that bigger picture of what's going on?
Oh my goodness. I wish there was a roadmap. I wish I had a structure. I mean, there was, I would say my process is on the one hand pure chaos, but I think also it's the only way I'm able to write and report. And, you know, I encourage this to all, you know, journalism students that I now talk to a lot. It's like, you know, going in without a preconceived notion of where your story is going is so hard and so intimidating and so overwhelming, but it's truly the way to really find all the pieces that you would never have thought to have looked for, you know? And so, I mean, I would say that the ultimate structure of the book, I would say the first half of the book kind of is told in the way that we talk. I think of the first half of the book as like, this is how we've been talking about sea level rise for the last couple of years. And then my editor and I have started to call chapter 7 the pivot chapter, where we really just start to broaden it to so many other things. Like, this is when we get to the reader, we're like, oh, you think this book is about sea level rise and the coast. It's also about this and this and this. And, you know, all of the and this's came just from the process of just continuing to get to know these communities, the science, the policy, and our history. And, you know, I would say, I mean, it's interesting, you know, after the first draft that I sent to my editor, the first full manuscript, she told me, like, oh my goodness, this book is an incredible blend of old school journalism, radical listening, and deep hanging out. And I just, like, I was so moved by that, because that I was like, oh my, someone just put into words like my, what has happened and like what I've experienced in the last, you know, couple years, just, and the radical listening and the deep hanging out part, I think just, you know, really trying to bring together all of these different pieces and just recognizing that, you know, there are so many voices and perspectives, and, you know, perspectives that are often in conflict with each other along our coast, but like everyone, you know, has a purpose and has a voice in this issue. And we can't move forward on this issue without making sure that everyone feels heard and without understanding kind of all of the different silos in which we're talking about this issue. And so, you know, really trying to bring all these voices together in, you know, one composed piece, so to speak, you know, attending to the tension, you know, and tension drives the story forward, tension drives music forward, and you kind of almost like leaning into that tension and recognizing, you know, what the propulsion is for the story. Yeah, and ultimately, this book is a chorus of voices coming together up and down our coast in a way that I don't think is in conflict with each other. There is harmony there, but it really took a lot of listening and a lot of thinking and a lot of notes and really chaotic story structuring to figure out how to tell the story of the coast.
Well, it is a great, I mean, it's an amazing story. There are many stories you've not told, for sure, but the ones that you have told are quite interesting. But there's one quote that to me is sort of the summary of what it is you're trying to address in much of this book. And it's in that last part, or the middle to last part, in chapter 9, it says, "Letting go of the fight against nature is the simpler, more philosophical part of the paradigm shift. Working with the rising sea and bringing back missing pieces of the shore within an environment already so altered and served by so many people? That's where things get messy.
Yes.
Add to this equation the social injustices that could be undone with it. A determined frame of mind, it seems daunting to do it all." That's what you're covering in the book, in my mind. That's the essence of what you're dealing. But talk a little bit about those messy parts that you alluded to and then cover so well in the book as well.
Yeah, where do I start? And thank you for pulling out that quote. I mean, that is truly like the heart and crux of like why we're stuck, right? And, you know, on the one hand, we are a couple things here. I mean, you know, in the process of just talking to folks, kind of getting a sense of like what it is that we're afraid of, what it is that we're afraid of losing, what it is that we are anxious about, and what it is that we want for our future. It's so interesting to me to think and realize that so many of us are still stuck in kind of the systems that we have created for ourselves that aren't necessarily serving us or our society anymore, but at the same time, we are now almost like making decisions to serve that system. And, you know, stepping back kind of like as a writer, I started really thinking about the words that we use to talk about climate change and sea level rise and adaptation. And for example, the word resilience came up a lot in when I talked to coastal planners, when I talked to scientists, but what does it actually mean to be resilient? I mean, the old school definition of resilience is kind of almost measured by our ability to bounce back exactly to the way things were before a disaster, right? Like our strength to remain unchanged. Katrina levels New Orleans and we shall rebuild. That is resilience to so many people. But that inherently implies that resilience is our ability to maintain the status quo. But is the status quo actually what we want? Is anyone asking that question? Is the status quo and all the systems that got us into the situation in the first place what we actually want? Is the status quo what, you know, underserved communities, you know, want going into the future? Is that fair? Is that equitable? These are all kind of questions that really expand kind of, again, that messiness. And Tammy Grove, actually, you know, also a wonderful Coastal Commission staffer, longtime Coastal Commission staffer, you know, once said to me, we talk so often in sea level rise, like about what it is that we are going to lose, but how do we reframe that conversation to think about what it is that we could like build and what we want going into the future? And I thought that was a really interesting reframing. And I think the other kind of messy part, and again, going back to, again, words that I've been wrestling with, the word restoration, and Leslie, I'm sure you come across this a lot too as a coastal engineer in your line of work, this idea of restoring something. And so now that we're talking about the ocean rising and this idea of like working, you know, with nature, or at least restoring more of nature and kind of attending to the fact that we have built and filled in a lot of our marshlands, for example, in the spirit of development. What does it mean to restore a wetland? What does it mean to restore destroyed habitats? And, you know, what are we restoring it back to? What is the baseline? And, you know, is restoration actually turning back the clock? Or is it thinking about how to adapt and quote unquote restore this landscape for a future that we don't quite understand yet? And that's messy too, because I think, you know, we get stuck too in a lot of debates about, okay, we're about to dismantle this like built environment to turn it back, quote unquote, back into a wetland. But what does that look like? And what are we turning it back into? And then we can get stuck literally for decades on what to do with that wetland. And, you know, And that's only focusing on the ecological aspects of it. And so for me, you know, with this book, it was also recognizing that people and communities are also part of the natural habitat and part of environmental writing. And so once you bring people in and social history in, it also gets really messy. But, you know, ultimately, responding to sea level rise is not just a old school environmental question. It is not just a science issue. It's also a social issue. And all of that is super, super messy, but something that we should lean into, because there is just within kind of this perceived threat of sea level rise and climate change, there is also so much opportunity to rethink the systems that got us here in the first place, to recognize and really rethink the communities that have been sacrificed or harmed in the process of building the world as we know it today, and to really rebuild and reimagine what it is that we could do better going into the future.
I think your story about Marin City is one that is, and in some ways, the outlier. They're not on the coast, but they're on the coast of the bay in a way. And they're certainly experiencing all the adverse consequences of sea level rise that other communities have yet to experience. But it is also, there's probably not a point at which Marin City wants to rebuild back. And yet it's a community now that's existing. It is a very messy spot with a lot of existing problems that they're trying to deal with. I liked that story in a macabre way, because it's not a very uplifting story, but for the people who are living there who feel a sense of community, there's probably other communities up and down the coast that have I think of Venice, which is the opposite kind of perspective we have on the coast, and they're addressing and confronting groundwater rise on a regular basis. It's not just the ocean coming in from the shoreline. There's water coming in other places. And I'm glad you recognized that and covered that in your book. Were there surprises that you discovered as you were talking with people who said, oh, you should go do this or see these folks and stuff? What were some of the nice surprises you had?
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning groundwater. That was one of the first, I had a couple like, oh my God moments. And I think the figuring out and learning about the groundwater rise was definitely one of those, because no seawall is going to be large enough to stop the groundwater rise. So we really have to rethink again, like how to live in better harmony with water, because water is trying to move back into all the places that water used to be. And so I would say groundwater was actually one of the major factual surprises. And, you know, this is making me think, my editor also after the first draft kind of told me that a book needs to not only attend to the reader's intellectual journey, which is something that I focus so much on as a reporter for the LA Times. You know, I gather the facts, I bring together the material and I show you what I've discovered and, you know, I present the information to you. But, you know, for a book, my editor was saying, it's not just the intellectual journey, it's also the emotional journey of the reader and ultimately the philosophical journey of the reader. So I think, you know, groundwater was definitely like a really surprise for me on my own intellectual journey of this book. And I think, you know, a lot of the things that surprised me the most were kind of the emotional aspects and the philosophical aspects of just exploring this issue and where it ultimately took me. And, you know, just attending to the emotions for a second. I mean, I think something that, I don't know if it surprised me. I know it certainly has surprised readers so far who have read the book and have messaged me. I mean, to have empathy for everyone, all sides, even the people that you wouldn't necessarily agree with, and to realize that we have commonality, even with someone that you would be like, oh, I don't even want to have, like, I don't even want to go to dinner with this person or run into them, you know, at the library. Like that is surprising to a lot of folks. But I think going out of my way to find commonality in everyone and really just piecing together this massive Venn diagram rather than really reinforcing all the reasons why we're different came as a surprise for a lot of readers. And I think maybe what was surprising to me is how much commonality we actually do have. And so, you know, I'll take a second here to just call out, you know, I think a lot of folks have a lot of preconceived notions of like property owners, right? And, you know, their resistance to a lot of the adaptation ideas and suggestions and truly like the steps that we are going to need to take towards this transformation and towards kind of this more sustainable future that we need to build towards. And yes, like there are definitely very wealthy, very politically powerful and influential property owners along our coast that are affecting the decision making, or at least are like our speed at which we can move on this issue. But also there are just so many property owners who are first-time homeowners who have just really sought to actually achieve the quote-unquote California dream. And what does it mean to, you know, how does it feel to meet a property owner, for example, who spent her whole life saving up money to buy the ugliest house on the prettiest street in town, a fixer-upper that, you know, but then the minute she moves in, she finds out that it's part of this broader discussion on manager tree, and there's a possibility for it to be relocated at some point, but no one's giving her a time frame. No one's giving her any clarity. She has no idea whether, like, you know, she just figured out her 30-year mortgage and, you know, all of these things. And, you know, we actually have a lot more commonality with this person than, you know, if you just said property owner and you're like, not me, not for me. This is something that, you know, I don't connect with. And they're the people who are stopping and in denial of everything. And so, but yeah, I think getting to the heart of folks' like emotions and why we're scared and why we're anxious, I think really shifts the conversation and also opens conversations in different ways. And I think that was maybe not surprising, but encouraging for me, that I found so many ways into conversations that I would say many folks might have thought were just non-starter conversations.
I mean, I think that you're talking about the property owner who gets a new home and, you know, has to deal with the 30-year mortgage and the issues that come with that and all the issues of a new home or a new to them home and fixing it up and such. The word you left out on that, which is coastal property owner, which has its own loaded components that come with it. Ultimately, many of the people who own property on the coast, as you're saying, are property owners, first-time property owners, for at least for where they are. And not all coastal property owners have their coastal property as their third or fourth home. There's a big distinction in that. And the idea, I think, that some people still bring from perhaps an East Coast perspective of many coastal properties being summertime recreational homes. Here, it's everyone lives there full time, or many of the people who are there live there full time. And your ending story of the people who live so long on the ranch up in the North Coast and the decisions made there is such a wonderful gleam of hope for ways to address this term that's been couched in trying to call it managed retreat versus unmanaged retreat, and people hear eminent domain within that, those words, and taking of property, and the idea of, I mean, I've gotten the government side that the natural forces are going to be taking some of this property. It's either managed or unmanaged, but talk about that ray of hope that you, some of the rays of hope you found in the book.
Yeah, and there was a lot of hope. I think, you know, a couple thoughts here. Like I think one of the interesting evolutions for myself, and also just kind of seeing how the broader public is kind of talking about this issue, and it has deepened and evolved in the years since I started writing about this issue. And I think my first interesting note of hope is just when I first started writing about sea level rise, I felt like it was mostly engineers and scientists in the room, kind of crunching the numbers, really looking pretty like scientifically at this issue and being like, okay, we've done the cost benefit analysis, we've done the life safety analysis, we know what is the most cost efficient and life safety efficient way forward. And here it is, you know, and it's like, duh. But, you know, then all like chaos broke out and the emotional backlash and the political backlash was intense. And so the number of engineers who have told me, this is not an engineering problem, you know, we can't science our way out of this issue, this is a social problem. And so for me, my first ray of hope is just seeing in the last few years, the number of social scientists who have entered the space of like sea level rise adaptation and climate change adaptation, you know, just going from like having like, which quote unquote experts do I talk to? How do I even wrap my mind around this to like being able to talk to like beach economists and, you know, adaptation specialists and environmental psychologists. And, you know, again, a lot of really interesting social scientists and really thinking and expanding kind of the way we think about this issue has really helped give us words and frameworks and just ways to think about this issue that feel more tangible and also allow us to think about, again, the messiness of this issue and kind of all these different pieces. And there's just greater clarity on like what we actually need to attend to move forward beyond just like the stark numbers that are showing us the clear, efficient path forward. And out of that has kind of emerged this recognition that the way we had been talking about responding to sea level rise still felt like this kind of like one-time action that communities felt like they had to make, right? This big step, this big one-time thing, that decision that they had to make that was going to dismantle everything, call for a lot of sacrifice and cost gazillion amounts of dollars, rather than thinking about responding to sea level rise as a process, like a very long-term step-by-step process. And, you know, how do we shift people's thinking from this like short-term fear and, you know, kind of hanging on to our short-term wants and needs to this longer-term, like this process towards a longer-term future, and helping people see that like, yes, we're asking you to eat your broccoli today so that you won't get a heart attack 70 years from now, but like, you know, but there are also a lot of things you can do in this in-between space. And also broccoli doesn't have to taste that bad. So like, they're just like, again, like I think even having metaphors and analogies like that has been super helpful. But yeah, and I think what gives me hope is the number of communities and local governments and, you know, state leaders who are starting to lean into the, okay, we're not asking people to make this like long-term change right now, but how do we get people to start moving out of this short-term space and entering this middle, like, you know, space, this transition space? And how do we begin this process? And what does that look like? How can we get creative? And, you know, I will say like some places have come up with these like short midterm projects that are, you know, essentially buying time to come up with longer term managed retreat processes that allow communities to feel like it's more fair and to give, you know, kind of infrastructure folks like more time to actually think about how to reconfigure a landscape, because we do need time to do that. I think other places have come up with these like kind of phased step-by-step like triggered approaches to changing parcel by parcel along the coastline or pieces of infrastructure, you know, as the ocean continues to move further inland. I have talked to so many interesting folks who have really, really helped me rethink the language that we use to talk about sea level rise adaptation. I mean, yes, managed retreat is certainly needs a rebrand. I think I'm preaching to the choir here on this podcast. But, you know, what does that actually mean? Like, you know, I've actually just been calling it like managed retreat. It's just moving, like living in better harmony with the ocean and recognizing that the ocean is moving inland. The coastline is meant to move in with it, and we're meant to move with that ever shifting line in the sand. And, very long story short, there's a lot of hope. You know, this book doesn't provide like solutions, but I think that there are just so many there are so many doors opened. The book helped me find all these places that have opened the door to different possibilities into a different future. And, you know, more than anything, I'm now starting to think about, maybe this is something I should, you know, bring up, that I, going back to your question about structure, see, can you tell that this is how, the way I talk is the way my first draft like looks. Yes. Like it's complete jumbled mess. I kind of find my thoughts and my structure, you know, 10 minutes in. And then, you know, the magic for me in my writing is the self-editing. But, you know, your question on structure earlier, I didn't know the ending to this book for a very, very long time, because how do you end a book about an issue that where the ending is still waiting to be written by all of us based on the decisions that we make today, right? And so I think the book ends, you know, spoiler alert, not in devastation. It ends with glimmers of hope. It ends with kind of all these places that I did find that, you know, where folks were doing their small part in trying to push our communities and push kind of California into these, you know, more sustainable, more like thoughtful, more creative, more transformative, you know, paths forward towards a different future than the one that we're currently barreling towards. And so, yeah, lots of hope, you know, could always ask for more and could always use more. So, you know, and that relies on kind of the decisions that we make today.
That's very true. A friend of mine in her email has as a byline, "All new learning looks at first like chaos." And that's an Adrienne Rich quote. And I think that's where we're in. This new learning about what for coastal engineers has been known for years is that the coast is very dynamic. But the idea that that dynamic coast means more than just a change of tides and storm waves once in a while, but actual movement is, in, to many folks, it's kind of a new learning process. And in defense of engineers, I think it was important that someone, and other scientists, of course, that there sort of be the, this is what's happening. Pay attention to it or not, but it's happening. And then the maybe the way the messages were provided or still are being provided by the engineers who aren't the best at perhaps always being socially adept. You know, when we're really outgoing engineers, we look at somebody else's shoes instead of our own when we're talking. So we need those other people to be jumping in and helping with all of the messaging. And I think that that is coming along. And the messaging is both science, it's both engineering, but it's also the human responses and the human opportunities that there are. So it's all jumbled in there, that you've put that into the balance of where we are. And you do represent some engineers nicely in the book and show that there are engineers as well as many other people are going to be part of these solutions that we get. And I think it's also true that perhaps the idea that when we put, here's what's going to happen in 2100, out there as the climate concern, people can't get engaged and they think we've got to jump into what we need to do for 2100 today. That idea of transition is really an important one. Which reminds me of the game that you put forth for the LA Times. And I was surprised it wasn't part of your book, but you want to talk a little bit about that. You remember the game?
Yes. Oh my goodness. Thank you for bringing up the game. And just one thought as you were speaking, I am going to, I'm blanking on who said this quote, but I have it. I'm staring at it right now. It's on a sticky note by my desk, but it's the quote, "Knowledge is the beginning of action and action is the completion of knowledge." And I think
that's circular.
Yeah. And sorry, what you were saying, that quote came to, as you were saying this, I was like staring at the sticky note. I'm like, yes. But this idea of kind of what that knowledge is and how much more expansive that knowledge needs to be beyond just, you know, what the science is saying is something that I've been really thinking about. But, you know, going back to the game. So yeah, I, for listeners who are not familiar, the book, before the book, I kind of published my first kind of bigger piece for the LA Times on sea level rise back in 2019. It was the, you know, the first time I kind of pieced together this story of this issue in California from kind of a statewide perspective, kind of, you know, really attending to all these different factors and these different communities and these different topographies. But then ultimately stepping back and thinking about how we all are fit into this, you know, very like broader landscape that, and in addition to that, we at the LA Times, like with an incredible team of, you know, computer programmers and graphic designers, we came up with the idea of creating an interactive game for the reader as well that you can play online. And we called it just The Ocean Game. And, you know, so I just remember talking to my editor at one point as we were coming up with like, the crux of the story, I was like, I feel like sea level rise is a game that everyone still thinks they can win. And they're just waiting for the right, you know, play or the right solution to fall into their laps. And my editor's like, we should make a game. I was like, oh my God, we should make a game. And the game essentially, you know, kind of breaks down. It's, I mean, super simplified, but it just helps kind of deliver the key points to the reader. But, you know, as I was first learning about this issue, like, you know, asking everyone, what are our options when it comes to like responding to sea level rise? Because honestly, the ocean will end up winning and the ocean will take all. And how, what is actually the win here and what are our options? And so, you know, very generally speaking, and I know there's a lot of kind of like gray space in between all these choices, but it's like we presented three choices in this game. Build a wall, add sand, or, you know, present buyouts to your community, and the player is the mayor of this hypothetical coastal town in California, and you have like a set amount of funds, and the ocean rises one notch per turn, and you have 8 turns basically to help move your town and to protect your town from the rising ocean. We don't really put a time element to it, and it just helps kind of the reader understand the politics of like, as a mayor of this hypothetical little coastal town, you get political points for building a seawall because that's an easy political win. You know, the ocean is rising and see, I built this wall to fend off the ocean. Yay. You know, we also show how adding sand costs like a third of your fund meter, but, and it helps, you know, make the sand and the beach, you know, really wide and everyone's happy for a summer. But then we show how it washes away, you know, and it's not permanent. And then with the buyouts, you know, we show how basically you have to basically know that on your first turn, you have to start the buyout process. Otherwise you run out of time and you run out of money if you don't. And usually the game is designed so that most people usually play it 2 or 3 times. But the first time everyone wants to build a wall, everyone plays with like the option of adding sand to the beach. And no one thinks to like actually click the buyout option until you've got like not a lot of money left and basically 1 or 2 turns left with before the ocean completely moves in. And the message is like, oh shoot, you should have started this sooner. And so then they'll play a second time and immediately start clicking on the buyout option. And you see how like by using every one of your turns before the ocean reaches the shoreline and reaches the homes, you can actually have time to like pace out this buyout. So again, it's kind of just like conveying the message that, you know, the only way to win, quote unquote, against quote unquote, the ocean is to start planning sooner and to like cut your losses sooner. And it was a really powerful way to help put readers in the hot seat of what like decision makers have to face today and kind of all the different political and social and economic decisions, the dynamics that weigh into our decisions. I would like to think it was pretty effective and, you know, could not bring that into the book, but that framework and this idea of cutting our losses sooner and starting the process sooner is definitely a recurring theme in the book.
there are so many situations where the time that takes to have an effective solution seems overly long to, I think, many people. But thinking about the area around Southern San Francisco Bay with Cargill Salt, it used to be Leslie Salt, the restoration project that's going on there, and just the 30-year effort to turn that into a different environmental area, that so many things take more time than people think they need to, but they also don't understand the messiness of the decision process. So that's a good story to remind people that things don't happen, even when we have a good solution, until everyone can buy into what that actual good solution is going to be. That's a great area, though. Did you get to spend much time in Aviso and down by the salt ponds?
Yeah, and, you know, I think there, I mean, I still have hope for the work that has been, the precedents that are being set, and honestly, kind of the bureaucratic kind of precedents within kind of the restoration world that has been set with some of the collaborations that have happened with the salt pond restoration in the South Bay, in the San Francisco South Bay. And I mean, it was bittersweet kind of meeting the number of folks who have dedicated their entire careers to a project that they won't see finished in their lifetimes. Because again, like so much of what it means, the plan for sea level rise transcends, you know, what it is that we're doing for ourselves, but it is truly doing what we're doing for the next generation or the next generation, right? And what's happening in Alviso, there's so much potential there. I think I've spoken to folks in the community who are really excited for what it would mean to have a revived wetland that could also provide a sense of like, at least like some sense of safety from like better flood protection in the future. Mm-hmm. And yeah, where we were stuck for a really long time with the wetland restoration in Alviso was this question of restoration and what we were actually restoring it back to. And if we were trying to turn back the clock, or if it was truly thinking about what it means to think forward towards the future. And I think that question, like, at what point is something, is a landscape so altered by what we've already done to it that the expectation to completely undo that is overly romanticized? And, you know, is the frame of mind actually thinking how we heal this landscape and prepare it for a future? And again, like, this future is still somewhat uncertain, but, you know, trying to think forward rather than hang on to the past is something that, you know, not like more people are kind of coming around to, but I would also say that was part of why it did take time, a lot of time, to get to the kind of milestones that wetland restoration project have finally hit in the last couple of years. And, you know, and I would say like cost is going to be another big question going into the future. Like, a lot of the work that needs to be done is going to cost a lot. How are we going to pay for that? Who is willing to pay? And are we willing to start making those decisions now? Because it's going to cost less if we start making those decisions now versus waiting more and more years.
Yeah, a lesson from the game. We have to get started on some things now. And then also from that quote that I so much like, letting go of the fight against nature is the simpler, more philosophical part of the paradigm shift. Doing nothing sometimes seems like that idea of letting go. And that's going to be very problematic in the future if that is how we treat our response to rising sea level. You write about all of the underground storage chemicals and dump areas that will just be released into the ocean if we're not careful about how we do let the ocean reclaim the coast. So there's a lot that has to be done to be respectful for future generations and not leave them in worse case situations than we're in now.
Yeah, and letting go and kind of not thinking about it is a privilege that some folks don't, like, you know, some folks can't not think about it. You know, the number, like you mentioned Marin City, and there's so many communities up and down the coast that aren't Malibu and aren't Laguna Beach. And, you know, the number of communities that, you know, we would define as like environmental justice communities that are, you know, stuck living on, you know, formerly industrial waste sites and are, have been concerned about flooding issues and have been concerned already about the Superfund site next door that still hasn't gotten cleaned up. You know, talk about things that take a really long time. You know, when I speak to folks in those communities, they've been, the things that they've been asking for decades, like clean, you know, cleaner air, soil that's not contaminated, clean water, like those are things that they needed before sea level rise became an urgent issue. And now, like, that cleanup is even more, like, that the need for that cleanup is even more urgent now that sea level rise is accelerating. And, like, to your point with groundwater and flooding, like, this the potential to remobilize contaminated, like, sites and how that could affect communities that are either situated on this contaminated soil or near this contaminated soil are huge questions that are, you know, constantly a concern for these communities. And, you know, that's something that they can't, they don't have the privilege to let go and ignore. So I also just want to highlight that too, that it's, these aren't easy issues. There are no easy solutions, but, you know, not like just not thinking about it can't be the answer because so much is at stake. And if we actually choose to like have these tough conversations, start making these decisions, then, you know, it doesn't have to be a question of what are we going to lose and what are we willing to lose. It could be, the question could be reframed to what it is that, what is it that we can gain and what it is that we can, you know, heal and restore and, you know, bring into the future.
Right. Going back to the quote from Tammy Grove that you mentioned of, you know, there are things to be gained as we look at the opportunities before us. Is there one community or one story you want to highlight as we start to wrap this conversation up?
Yeah, I think maybe not like a specific town, but I would just say that all of the Indigenous women, Indigenous scientists, Indigenous thinkers that I met along this journey have really helped me expand the way we could be thinking about the coast, our coast, you know, and how we got to where we are today. And, you know, as a reporter, I'm constantly thinking about how when, you know, when you quote someone, you give them power. When you choose to share their stories, you give them power. And I think in the process of thinking about, you know, making sure I talk to everyone at the table, it was also for me thinking about all the people who, that are not at the table that should be at the table and really bringing them to the table. But, you know, I think, I mean, and this is something that I feel like a lot of folks like you, Leslie, and like kind of the worlds that we are constantly, you know, just like engaging with, like, there's a lot of interest in Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous wisdom now, but how do we bring those perspectives and expertise into the conversation in a way that doesn't feel like it's either separate from Western science or in conflict with Western science? Because it's not, but I think there is like those extra steps that need to be taken to weave the two together in a way that feels like they are building on each other. And they do. And it's really incredible to think about all the ways that, you know, again, like there's so much more commonality than difference in even, you know, the West, like the ways we think about this issue. And so, yeah, just thinking about like the idea of reciprocity with the ocean and with the land, for example, has been really grounding for me. I feel like there's just like this, these ideas of like, and these philosophies of just living, attending to the fact that, you know, the coastline is inherently not a fixed line in the sand, and that like the coast is this dynamic space that we're actually supposed to move with. And even just like at a very, very simple level, like really, really, truly recognizing that, you know, people are not separate from nature. We are part of nature. And even I think, you know, as I was reading, you know, a lot of books and like kind of things within the nature writing genre, like so often we still write and think about nature as these like separate pristine places that we protect and then we go visit and then we go home, right? And so kind of, again, thinking about how all of our environment, even our built environments, like are nature and that we are a part of it and that we have a responsibility to be better stewards of it. And again, like I just think every conversation I had with kind of various indigenous communities up and down coastal California really just expanded and deepened the way like I thought about the issue. And, you know, it's, I'm really excited to bring those perspectives into this book. And yeah, it's just, it's sad. I don't know. Maybe that's not the right word, but I think I was just so struck too by like, you know, I mean, how many, like the fact, you know, I was talking to someone who told me like, I don't think a single Ahashimam person actually lives on the coast in Orange County because no one can afford it. So it's like, you know, this, you know, these communities were pushed out and now they're priced out. And I think also just rethinking kind of like, again, like who hasn't been at the table that also belongs, you know, in this conversation. And yeah, it was really inspiring. And I'm not sure if that was the answer you're looking for in your question, but I would say indigenous communities in general and just really recognizing the expertise in the perspectives and the voices from, you know, just our indigenous neighbors who no longer live on our coast today because of our really fraught history, but, you know, who are still present today and who still have so much knowledge that, you know, has existed this whole time, if only we are willing to listen and to engage and to think and think more deeply about.
Well, I think this is not going to be the right word, but the sentience to which many people give the ocean, many of the indigenous peoples who lived along the ocean, is also one of the points that jumped out at me from reading your book. So we can talk about favorite beaches, writers who've inspired you and such, but how about the Rainbow Bridge as a first or as a final short story?
Yeah, and I, you know, we talked about how I had no idea.
I know it's not yours, but yeah.
No, so like we had talked earlier about how I didn't know how to end the book, but the minute I talked to Alicia Cordero from Wishtoyo Foundation, and she's, you know, both a biologist and a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation, you know, the minute I heard her present this like expanded interpretation of the Rainbow Bridge story, I was like, oh my God, that's the beginning of the book. So I've known for a very long time how I wanted to begin the book. And so, you know, I was riffing and reflecting with Alicia, and, you know, we were going for a walk along one of her favorite beaches in, you know, present day, what is known as Santa Barbara. And she was saying, you know, the Rainbow Bridge story, it's one of the oldest like Chumash tales. And it's about how everyone once lived on this one giant island called Limu. And then, you know, Limu got too crowded and everyone, like a lot of the people had to move. And so, you know, there was a rainbow bridge that took them from the island to the mainland. And she was saying to me, like, yes, this was a story that has always captivated her since she was a child, but, you know, it's also possibly the oldest record of sea level rise in California. And, you know, Limu was one giant island, you know, that became four of the Channel Islands, you know, as, you know, the ocean fluctuated and changed. And yeah, like, you know, again, like who do we value as like expert? What do we use? What do we value as data and information? And this was just like a really powerful way to open the book and to think about, again, the fact that the coastline is always changing. The ocean, this dance between ocean and land has been, you know, an age old marriage and dance that like has been happening for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And before we settled California the way we've settled it today, like we knew how to live, people knew how to live in better harmony with this changing coastline. So I encourage everyone to read it. I'm not doing it justice now. And that was definitely one of the hardest chapters to write, and to really give it the power that it deserves. And, you know, I hope I did it right. And I hope thank you for bringing that up, because that was one of the most powerful shifts for me too, as I was reporting and gathering material for the book.
Great. And I know you want to say thank you to Heyday Press for having put your book out. And thank you to all the local bookstores who are putting it on their shelves and having readings for your climate tours, you want to call it, rather than a book tour.
It has been so wonderful meeting so many people in so many different places. And we do have so many independent bookstores to thank for creating just the space to chat and to talk and to reflect on the future together. And yeah, as you were saying, like, I feel like I'm still wrapping my mind around the words book tour, but I have, as my editor put it, she's like, you're not on book tour, Rosanna, you're on a everyone needs to talk about sea level rise tour. And I was like, yes, everyone needs to talk about sea level rise. And yes, huge shout out to Heyday. This book would not exist without an indie press based in Berkeley who really believed that we could publish an entire book on California and really attend to the nuances of this incredibly diverse state, rather than, you know, turn it into one more stereotypical chapter about California in a broader book about climate change. And so I do want to shout out Heyday for really believing in the vision for this book.
Favorite beach? Do you have one?
Leslie, that's like asking who my favorite child is out of 1,295 miles of coastline. Do you have a favorite beach?
I just had my favorite for today is at Fitzgerald Marine Reserve at Moss Beach.
But that's a good one.
It's just the favorite for today.
You've asked me a lot of questions today. This is the hardest one. What am I going to say as my favorite beach? Can I say, okay, so my favorite beach to take people to when they visit me in Los Angeles, so again, I'm kind of confining the space, is the Pilot Dune Project by the Bay Foundation and, like, you know, an incredible team of coastal dune restoration scientists. But if you go to, like, you know, you park kind of near the Annenberg Beach House in Santa Monica and you walk, you know, a little bit along the bike path, you'll see just kind of this like space that is set aside basically to show what a natural beach could look like if you just didn't, you know, drive a tractor over it twice a day and clean up all the kelp rack and, you know, allow for the plants to take root and to allow all the sand to accumulate, and you start to see these like really beautiful dune formations. And it's just this really cool pilot demonstration of like what the beach could look like if we were to allow it to be wild again. And, you know, really the potential for dunes also to serve as a natural buffer between, you know, the rising ocean and kind of our existing infrastructure. So that's definitely my favorite spot on the beach to take folks to when they visit me. Like, I was like, look at, you know, the wide, sandy, flattened, manicured beaches of Santa Monica, and look at what this beach could look like, and all of the cool people who have really made that dune possible.
Perfect. I'm sure all those cool people who worked on it appreciate your recognition of it. We could keep talking for a long, long time, but I think it's time to say thank you so much, Rosanna, for writing California Against the Sea, for talking today on this podcast about your book. And I hope those who are listening have enjoyed it. And till next time, enjoy the coast and your views toward the shore. Goodbye.